Really Massoud's misfortune to have crossed the line. Even after the Marriott bombing, during an in-camera session of Parliament that autumn, ISI officers briefing Pakistani lawmakers tried to explain the virtues of some Taliban elements versus the real militants. The ISI briefers reasoned small numbers from some of the militant groups could be useful in future operations in Kashmir or elsewhere. Anyone in Washington reading the U.S. government's own cable traffic would have ample reason to regard ISI reform as an unlikely prospect. Mike Mullen doubted that Kayani would follow through on the CIA's proposed reform list. His relationship with Kayani was just months old, but it was becoming deeper. By protocol, as America's most senior military officer, Mullen was Kayani's counterpart. The admiral intended his willingness to devote more and more time to Kayani as a signal of respect and seriousness. Over the next 3 years, Mullen would play the good cop with Kayani, in tandem with a rotating cast of American bad cops. Mullen had the least likely upbringing of anyone wearing 4 stars in the American military. His mother had worked as an assistant to Jimmy Durante, the comedian. She met his father in the publicity department of Republic Pictures. Jack Mullen struck out on his own as a Hollywood press agent, whose clients included Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, Peter Graves, Anne Margaret, Anthony Quinn, and Julie Andrews. His son Mike, one of 4 brothers, grew up in North Hollywood and the San Fernando Valley among actors, vaudevillians, comedians, and gossip columnists. Except for one uncle who was a veteran, his family had little military heritage. Mullen was tall and athletic, and enrolled at the Naval Academy as a basketball recruit in 1964. He rose in the Navy as an operations manager and collaborative, people-centric leader. Congenial, self-effacing, curious, he was a natural for staff command, liaison with foreign militaries, and Pentagon process. A sailor diplomat who placed his faith in relationships, made himself accessible, and did not seek to bend the world to his will. The Democrats had taken control of Congress and looked, with Obama, to be in a strong position for the 2008 presidential vote. Mullen was an ideal figure to communicate across the aisle. Mullen resided in the chairman's residence on 23rd Street, across from the State Department. He and his wife were Broadway enthusiasts and covered their home's walls with framed playbills from the musicals and plays they had seen. Learning about Afghanistan, he was enthralled by Greg Mortensen's book, 3 Cups of Tea, the national bestseller about schools and culture. He read copiously, hired advisors to connect him to think tanks and humanitarian organizations like Doctors Without Borders, and tried to get out of Washington as often as possible. He visited Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan at least once a quarter. The Navy regularly produced leaders with some of Mullen's characteristics. Army and Marine generals did not require much prompting to joke about admirals with their feet up on a ship's bridge, cruising the world's open seas, smoking cigars, and thinking great thoughts about world order. But even for a Navy man, Mullen was ambassadorial. The question was whether he had a sharp enough mind of his own to shape the disastrous conflicts he had inherited. Mullen's relationship with Kayani was the most difficult, intense of the liaisons with world military leaders worldwide. Between early 2008 and the summer of 2011, Mullen would travel to Pakistan 27 times to spend time with Kayani. He met the general many other times, in Washington, Europe, and elsewhere, and they spoke frequently by secure telephone. Mullen had no experience in Pakistan. That summer of 2008, he relayed to Kayani in their early meetings talking points developed by his Afghanistan-Pakistan staff, the CIA, and the White House. Nadeem Taj at ISI Must Go was one such talking point. But mainly he tried to connect the lengthy classified memos in his briefing books to what he observed and heard during long, open-ended conversations with the general. By the fall of 2008, Mullen was forming a hypothesis about Directorate S, one aligned with intelligence reporting. At the very top of its hierarchy, ISI was a black-and-white organization, fully subject to discipline and accountability, Mullen told colleagues. In the middle, the organization started to go gray, fading into heavily compartmented operations that drew upon mid-level officers, civilians, contractors, and retirees. Then there were retired ISI director generals, or senior brigadiers, with their own followings among militants, such as Hamid Ghul, who had run the service during the late 1980s. At their first conference in Islamabad, Kayani presented a list of 7 counterterrorism and surveillance technologies that he said Pakistan needed urgently. He emphasized that Pakistan needed its own signals intelligence intercept ability. Kayani's list included technology to intercept and listen to satellite telephone conversations, digital or GSM cell phones, mobile platforms that would allow Pakistan to locate cell phones quickly, and aerial collection platforms for Pakistani aircraft that could intercept low-powered military radio transmissions. He said he was not interested in acquiring and operating Predator drones, but he wondered if there were smaller, less expensive tactical drones that the United States could grant or lend to Pakistan for surveillance in Waziristan. Kayani's other great need was helicopters, Cobra or Apache gunships to strike militant compounds, and more Chinook transports to quickly lift special forces to and from attacks. Waziristan's vast terrain and muddy roads had trapped Pakistan's infantry-heavy army into a lumbering, defensive position, holed up on bases. Helicopters were a tough ask, Mullen warned Kayani. Everybody in NATO seemed to need more. The supply chain was stressed. The admiral pledged to send a team of National Security Agency and other experts out to Pakistan to study the Army's SIGINT capabilities and needs, to see what the United States might be able to do. From the start, Kayani's requests for state-of-the-art surveillance technology strained the trust Mullen sought to build. Cell phone intercept equipment, night vision goggles, and aerial SIGINT platforms could be used to thwart the Taliban or enable them. If the United States supplied such gear, would it make ISI and the Special Services Group more dangerous? Kayani told Mullen that his army had to focus on the fundamentals of Pakistan's internal security. By this he meant public opinion and the fighting morale of his soldiers when forced to kill fellow citizens preaching revolution in the name of Islam. Kayani feared that too many of the army's rank and file doubted the righteousness of the fight in alliance with the United States. What is fundamentalism? What is extremism? Kayani asked, as he traveled from cantonment to cantonment that year, speaking to officers and enlisted men. To his generals, he emphasized, "We have to define extremism so that it's the 98% against the 2%. We can't define it so that it's 50-50 or 60-40. Then we'll be fighting a civil war. Different opinions don't make someone an extremist. It's when they take no one's advice, when they arrogate to themselves the right to define who is a Muslim or who is legitimate. When this person picks up the gun, he becomes a terrorist. This is how you make it 98-2. 4 decades of promoting faith as a source of morale in the Pakistan Army had made it necessary to distinguish between fundamentalism and extremism in order to hold the army together, Kayani believed. That meant tolerating the conservative practice of individual faith while waging a counter-revolutionary campaign against those who challenged the state's legitimacy. It was necessary to accept a rising tide of Islamism in the military and public life in order to maintain unity against Al-Qaeda and Pakistani Sunni extremists. The army has to detach itself from America, Kayani told his corps commanders. This is our fight. Our war. This is not a U.S. war. Kayani suggested to Mullen that they convene a conference with senior commanders from both countries about joint strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Let's have a very open discussion, he proposed. Mullen jumped at the suggestion. In late August, Kayani flew secretly across the Arabian Sea to the USS Abraham Lincoln, an American aircraft carrier. In addition to Mullen, the U.S. delegation included David Petraeus, who had just been appointed to lead Central Command, Admiral Eric Olson of Joint Special Operations Command, and General Martin Dempsey, then acting head of Central Command. Kayani brought along Major General Ahmed Shuja Pasha, then Director General of Military Operations. They talked for at least 8 hours over 2 days, trading PowerPoint decks and maps. Kayani pledged to be transparent about his campaign plan in the tribal areas over the next 2 years. The army was in the midst of an undeclared surge of troops into Waziristan, Kayani said. He did not want to inflame the locals further by announcing the troop deployments, but he had rotated in tens of thousands of infantry from mainland Pakistan or the Indian border. Kayani presented charts of major operations carried out by brigade-sized units. With Musharraf gone, he had removed Orakzai and abandoned the failed negotiations with Taliban and tribal leaders. Yet there could be no purely military solution in the region. We're carrying out operations against our own people, Kayani emphasized. It has to be done subtly. All Kayani had to do was read the newspapers to understand that many in Washington, probably many of the commanders on the Abraham Lincoln, believed that he was hedging his bets in Afghanistan by covertly enabling the Taliban's revival. He tried once more to persuade them that it wasn't so. No outside power had ever controlled Afghanistan, Kayani often pointed out. Pakistan had a vitally important relationship with the West at stake. We can't be controlling Afghanistan, he said. That would mean we haven't learned anything. He warned Mullen and the generals, however, don't expect too much, because I can't do everything. Major ground operations in North Waziristan would have to wait as he built up forces, morale, and political support from civilian politicians. He needed help, technology, equipment, and patience. If your expectation is here, he said, gesturing at eye level, and our abilities are there, he said, dropping his hand, the gap will be frustrating. About that, he was prescient. The American commanders on the Abraham Lincoln generally respected Kayani. He cared about soldiering. He was reticent and professional, if also hard to comprehend, literally when he spoke, and more broadly, as a mystery of intentions. The conference also gave Mullen, Petraeus, and the others their first sustained look at Kayani's trusted lieutenant, Ahmed Shuja Pasha. About 5'8", clean-shaven, with a glint of gray in his eyes, Pasha displayed little of Kayani's reticence. He was energetic, openly emotional. He clearly had the army chief's confidence. Like Kayani, Pasha was the self-made product of a modest Punjabi middle-class family and had grown up without access to wealth or social privilege. 5 weeks after the conference, Kayani named Pasha the next Director General of ISI. It would prove to be a momentous choice. Chapter 19. Terror and the Deep State. The new ISI chief's family had come originally from India, in the Punjab, and had migrated to what was now Pakistan before partition. Ahmed Shuja Pasha's father attended government college in Lahore, and then moved his family to a village about 40 miles from Islamabad. He taught high school there. He had 3 daughters and 4 sons. Ahmed was the youngest boy. They were not poor, but it was a strain to raise 7 children on a teacher's salary. By the time Ahmed came of age, the family had fallen under financial pressure. One of his brothers had enlisted in the Air Force. The other 2 brothers had joined the Pakistan Army. His father urged him to become a scholar, but Ahmed wanted to follow his brothers. He passed the admission exam for the Pakistan Military Academy in Abbottabad, equivalent to West Point. He enrolled there during the spring of 1972. This was less than a year after Pakistan's devastating defeat in its third war with India, a military and political catastrophe that led to the dismembering of the country and the birth of independent Bangladesh on the former territory of East Pakistan. The humiliation left many young Pakistani military officers thirsting for revenge against India. Pasha graduated as a second lieutenant assigned to the infantry. Two of his brothers left the military after relatively short periods, one after falling ill, and the other following disciplinary infractions. The third brother eventually became a brigadier. Ahmed rose steadily. His assignments included a tour on the line of control in Kashmir, the militarized de facto border where Pakistani and Indian troops routinely skirmished and shelled one another. He was also selected for advanced military education abroad, at the German Staff College in Hamburg, where he learned German. He married and raised a family, but was tested by tragedy just as his professional success seemed assured. His eldest son died in a car accident that took place on Pasha's birthday. It was a wound so deep that it would surface unexpectedly and emotionally in conversation, even with American counterparts with whom he had complicated relations. Pasha never studied in the United States. He did not send his surviving children abroad for college or graduate education, as many elite Pakistani families and generals did. By the time he reached his 50s and won promotion to general, Pasha's decision to school his children in Pakistan had become a part of his identity. He seemed increasingly to define himself in opposition to the globalized salons of Karachi, Islamabad, and Lahore, and he expressed contempt for their cosmopolitanism. "Your problem," he once announced to a Pakistani journalist with whom he had become annoyed, "is that you're an elitist, whereas I began my life as a son of a schoolteacher. I sat on a mat on the floor and learned to read and write. We are homespun. We are nationalists. We are not like your Sandhurst friends, not like Musharraf." He saw the army as a kind of Spartan force defending, even as it was undermined by, Pakistan's dissipated, privileged landed families. "Why is the army different from the rest of society?" he once asked a visitor. "Training is part of the answer, but there is more. It comes in the end from a feeling of responsibility. Young men pick this up in good schools or in the army. A lieutenant will say that he wants to repay what he has been given, that he wants to serve. The army is very different from the rest of the country." On September 11th, Pasha was posted to a UN peacekeeping mission in Sierra Leone. After he returned to Pakistan as a two-star general, he seethed at Musharraf's accession to American demands. On security policy, Pasha was essentially in the Mahmoud Ahmed camp. He believed that if the United States negotiated with the Taliban, with Pakistan serving as an intermediary, the region might be stabilized, and even bin Laden could be located with the Taliban's assistance. At private commanders' conferences, Pasha made a habit of challenging Musharraf, to such an extent that he wondered if he would be fired. But he wasn't. Instead, he made a favorable impression on Kayani, who shared some of Pasha's views, but did not make such a display of them. Pasha had not worked closely with American generals or spies until 2006, when he became Director General of Military Operations. "The United States had fine intentions for Pakistan," Pasha said repeatedly, "and he appreciated all that American aid had done to support the country's economy. Yet he also thought that American diplomats in Islamabad trapped themselves by over-reliance on Pakistan's debased elites. A relatively small circle of politicians, corrupt businessmen, and journalists misled the United States about Pakistan's true character and assumptions," Pasha told his American interlocutors. In the years to come, some of the Americans who worked with Pasha would come to think of him as an extreme nationalist, overly emotional and prickly, a man who seemed to take everything personally. Pasha certainly made no apologies for his nationalism. He embraced it. Pasha stated his politics plainly and in line with the views of many educated urbanized Pakistanis, in uniform and out. I want to live in a country where my kids don't have to choose between a Bhutto and a Sharif. The Americans wanted Pasha to embrace Pakistan's counter-terrorism alliance with the United States, more or less as Musharraf had done. Going further in 2008, they wanted him to recognize that ISI's tolerance of domestic militants and the Afghan Taliban was unsustainable and unacceptable. Pasha bristled at such talking points. "Of course we have links with these guys," Pasha would tell American counterparts when they pressed him about ISI's relations with the Haqqani network. "Of course we influence them. Of course you can have phone taps of us talking with them. We talk to them, I imagine, the way the FBI talks to the mafia. That doesn't mean they do what we say." He came to understand that virtually every American he met with professionally believed that he was a liar and assumed that any particular claim he made about ISI's operations could be a lie. The suspicion galled him. 155 Americans lost their lives in the Afghan War during 2008, an increase of about a third from the previous year. British, Canadian, and other NATO casualties also rose to their highest levels since the war began. It seemed all but guaranteed that 2009 would be worse. The Taliban had improved their fighting tactics. They had stopped investing great effort in ineffectual suicide bombers, reserving those dark networks more often for strategic assassinations of Afghan office holders. They had learned to avoid massed infantry fighting that invited NATO to call in its air power on defenseless Taliban positions. They had ramped up their manufacture and use of improvised explosive devices detonated by pressure or remote control. Roadside bombs, mines on footpaths, bicycle bombs, even the occasional donkey bomb. The Taliban mounted some 3,867 improvised explosive attacks during 2008, an increase of almost 50% over the previous year. Just as had been the case for Soviet forces during the 1980s, the improvised bombs and mines forced NATO to restrict its movements, tempted forward commanders to hunker down on bases, and left platoons to struggle with the random devastation the bombs inflicted on comrades who lost legs, arms, and lives. David Kilcullen, the unconventional warfare specialist advising Condoleezza Rice, returned to Pakistan and Afghanistan that year. The Taliban clearly had professional help, he could now see. Their indirect fire from mortars and rockets had become more accurate. They had acquired heavy sniper weapons and optics, which demand training. Some units even had uniforms with badges of rank. He and other American analysts also started to grasp that the Taliban forces operated a formal rotation system: training in Pakistan, field deployment, and then rest and recuperation back in Pakistan. Pakistan Army and Frontier Corps troops along the Pakistani border were firing on American border posts to provide covering fire for the Taliban to infiltrate into Afghanistan and return. The same tactics Pakistani forces employed for Kashmiri militants along the line of control. In Washington, Kilcullen's report reinforced the case that the Afghan war was spiraling in the wrong direction. At the White House, about once a quarter, National Security Advisor Steve Hadley invited the NSC's Afghanistan staff to his office for an informal roundtable discussion. Doug Lute, the two-star general and war czar coordinating both Iraq and Afghan policy, would attend these sessions, along with John Wood, the senior NSC director for Afghanistan, and his colleagues, including Paul Miller, Krista Scarry, and Marie Richards. Pakistan was a perennial topic. So was Afghan governance. Hadley would throw out a question such as, "How do you build a police force in a country as broken as this?" The conversation would range widely. Hadley listened, but rarely revealed his own opinion. Since Doug Lutz's arrival at the White House in mid-2007, Iraq had consumed almost all of his attention. President Bush was committed to the primacy of Iraq. He was more personally invested. In the interagency committees, while trying to turn the Iraq war around, Lute had developed a circle of confidants, civilians with an analytical bent, including David Gordon and Elliot Cohen, and, at the Pentagon, Jim Shin, who had made a fortune in the software industry before joining government, and Mary Beth Long, the international lawyer who worked on counter-narcotics. They had bonded over Iraq's unrelenting crises. By mid-2008, however, the surge of troops into Baghdad that Bush had authorized 18 months earlier under Petraeus's command had reduced the violence there. There was now greater breathing space to consider Afghanistan. Lute was a large, affable, humorously skeptical general who had risen high because of his facility for operations and process. He had grown up in Michigan City, Indiana, an Eagle Scout and president of his high school class. He won acceptance to West Point 1 year behind the class Petraeus dominated, marrying the superintendent's daughter, among other achievements. Lute chose the armored cavalry upon graduation in 1975. He spent much of his early career with a cavalry regiment in Germany tasked to hold off the Soviets at the outbreak of World War III. He took a master's degree at Harvard, taught international politics at West Point, fought in a cavalry unit during the First Gulf War, worked on the Balkans during the 1990s, and landed as a military assistant to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Hugh Shelton in 2000. General John Abizaid, then leading Central Command, recruited Lute as his J3, or Chief Operations Officer, just as the Iraq War turned into a bloody grind. Of Lebanese descent, Abizaid was the first Arab-American to wear 4 stars. Lute traveled continually with him to both Iraq and Afghanistan. If Petraeus increasingly led the school of generalship in the army that advocated for counterinsurgency, a doctrine that typically required long timelines and state-building, Abizaid was the most credible voice of an opposing school of thought. He believed counterinsurgency carried out by large numbers of highly visible American forces in Muslim societies over a long period of time was unlikely to succeed because locals would revolt before there was time for the United States to achieve the expansive political and economic objectives that counterinsurgency theory promoted. Repeatedly, Abizaid warned colleagues about Iraq and Afghanistan. The clock is ticking on the American presence. The Petraeus network within the army sometimes dismissed such thinking as defeatism. Abizaid considered his warning to be realism. He had burned his convictions into Doug Lute's head by the time the Bush White House recruited Lute as war czar, or, as he was sometimes referred to less provocatively, a senior coordinator. In May 2008, Lute arranged for a Gulfstream 5 jet to carry him, Cohen, Gordon, Shin, and Long to Afghanistan. They heard much to be discouraged about. Road building was behind schedule, and the roads that had been completed weren't being defended successfully. Battlefield intelligence collection seemed disconnected from strategy. The system was a massive vacuum cleaner of stray facts, feeding into conclusions that were not rigorous, as Long put it. The chain of command was a fractured mess. As an operations man, Lute was especially appalled by the incoherent command structure that had grown up in Afghanistan as a result of ad hoc compromises with NATO and within the American military. In Kandahar, the group spent hours poring over battle maps of Kandahar and Helmand as local NATO commanders inventoried all the units deployed in their areas. These included American black or covert special operations units, white or green beret-style American special forces, British forces, Dutch forces, U.S. Marines, and multinational provincial reconstruction teams. There were also small international training units embedded with the Afghan army. These officers reported through their own chain of command to Kabul. By the time they were done, they had identified more than half a dozen distinct NATO or American armed forces operating in southern Afghanistan. only one of which the top NATO general on the scene in Kandahar commanded. This patchwork was the legacy of Rumsfeld's reluctance to deploy in Afghanistan, NATO's fractured system of military federalism, and the insistence of U.S. Special Operations Command and the U.S. Marines that they operate independently, which Rumsfeld and then Gates had accepted. American officers told them about a soldier wounded in the foot near Herat in western Afghanistan. If he had been struck above the waist, he likely would have bled out and died because of the lengthy time required for Spanish commanders, who were deployed in the region, to request permission from the NATO chain of command to dispatch a rescue helicopter. That episode became a touchstone for Gates, the new defense secretary. The bleed-out time in Afghanistan, the time a wounded soldier had to wait for specialized help to arrive, was about 2 hours on average. Gates pushed to reduce it to 1 hour. The study team spent long hours on the flight home, over wine and baguettes, discussing what they had seen. They agreed that Afghanistan and Pakistan had to be understood as a unified theater and set of problems. Back in Washington, Lute briefed the Interagency Deputies Committee about the command problem. Besides the half a dozen overt military commands, no one in this room has good visibility on the CIA with partnered Afghan intelligence units, Lute said. That summer, Lute sent a memo to Bush warning that the Afghan war could fall apart during the next 6 months as the president departed office. Bush wrote back almost immediately. He wanted to work on the problems even though the time was short. Hadley told Lute, "I want to launch a very deliberate look at this." The National Security Council met on September 17th. Bush told his war cabinet he wanted a review similar to the one that had produced the recommendation for a troop surge into Baghdad, a decision in which Bush took pride. That launched the last and most ambitious of his administration's strategy reviews on Afghanistan. During the next 2 months, Lute convened 16 sessions lasting a total of more than 40 hours in room 445 of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, a secure conference room. Deputies of roughly Lute's rank in the national security bureaucracy staffed the study from the Pentagon, the State Department, CIA, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the Office of the Vice President, and other agencies. Typically, there were about 24 people in the room. The review went topic by topic. Poppy and heroin, corruption, Afghan security force training, NATO's command structure, Pakistani sanctuaries. Typically, an intelligence analyst such as Peter Lavoie of the National Intelligence Council or Tony Scannella of the CIA's Military Analysis Unit would open a session with an in-depth presentation. Scannella's team updated the CIA's top-secret district assessment maps for the review. In the years ahead, the agency would revise the maps every 6 months, in part because they were so popular. After their briefings, the intelligence analysts would usually leave, and the political appointees and generals from the Pentagon would debate what should be done. The NSC staff under Lute also produced memos concerning basic questions about the war, ones that might seem worrying to be asking after 7 years of involvement. Why was the United States still in Afghanistan? What did it want to achieve? Was it necessary to crack down on corruption to achieve America's strategic goals? Was it necessary to invest in reconstruction and governance to succeed at counterterrorism? The apparent success of the Baghdad surge, skillfully promoted in the media by Petraeus, had created a kind of intellectual bubble in Washington around his ideas. Diplomats, generals, and aid workers toted thumbed copies of Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, a history of counterinsurgency by an Oxford-educated protege of Petraeus's, Lieutenant Colonel John Nigel. Philip Zelikow, a historian and counselor to the State Department while working on the Iraq War, had coined a phrase that now became a kind of mantra in Room 445. Clear, hold, build. Zelikow meant that a counterinsurgency campaign should seek to clear enemy-held areas by military force, hold them, and build popular consent through reconstruction and better governance. Zelikow was no longer in government. He did not actually believe that the formula he had developed for Iraq policy would work in Afghanistan, because of the problems of Pakistan's sanctuaries, weak governance, and poverty. Yet the consensus in Room 445 was that the United States needed to resource a more full-bodied counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan, which would involve more reconstruction aid and training of Afghan security forces. They believed the central government in Afghanistan still had a chance to establish itself. The Taliban were on the upswing, but did not threaten a takeover of Kabul or the overthrow of Karzai's regime. The idea was to carry out counterinsurgency primarily through Afghan security forces, but to give the 40,000 or so Western soldiers then in the country a new focus. The support for a larger counterinsurgency mission in Afghanistan, more money, more troops, and more diplomats, introduced a logic problem that would bedevil American strategy in the war for the next several years. The purpose of the American intervention in Afghanistan was to defeat Al-Qaeda, which remained dangerous, everyone at the table agreed. However, Al-Qaeda was primarily in Pakistan. So why carry out counterinsurgency against the Taliban in Afghanistan? The answer the review arrived at was that only by creating conditions in Afghanistan that precluded a full Taliban comeback and takeover could Al-Qaeda be prevented from restoring itself in a sanctuary similar to what it had enjoyed in Afghanistan on the eve of September 11th. Al-Qaeda is more disrupted than at any time since October 2001, but the organization is damaged, not broken, as Peter Lavoie summarized some of the thinking at a NATO briefing that autumn. The international community cannot afford to let pressure off Al-Qaeda because it has demonstrated an ability to reconstitute itself in the past and could easily reverse migrate back to Afghanistan if the Taliban were to regain control. The consequences of failing in Afghanistan and permitting Al-Qaeda to shift its center of gravity to Afghanistan would pose a threat to all nations inside their borders. The argument made sense, but as a rationale for putting tens of thousands more American and European soldiers in harm's way, it had an indirect, speculative quality. Al-Qaeda had established itself in Pakistan and had no need of Afghanistan. And seeking to defeat the Taliban in a counterinsurgency campaign was a much different kind of war from the CIA and Special Operations covert war against Al-Qaeda or the supposed peace enforcement operations sold to NATO governments as their militaries rotated to the south. The CIA's operating directives still tasked operators and analysts to focus on Al-Qaeda. They had no orders from the White House to help defeat the Taliban, according to what agency leaders told their British counterparts at the time, to the latter's dismay, given the rate that British soldiers were taking casualties in Helmand inflicted by the Taliban. On October 15th, Lute, Cohen, and Shin flew back on their Gulfstream jet to Afghanistan and Pakistan to conduct a week of field interviews before writing up the strategy review. They traveled to the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan at Torkham. Lute's marine aide arranged for a kosher TV dinner to be brought along for Cohen, who was fairly certain he consumed the first kosher meal ever transported there. The big questions were, first, were NATO and the United States winning or losing? A second was trying to figure out what the enemy's game plan was. The intelligence remained poor. Cohen concluded that American analysts were much better at counting things than extracting strategic insights. A third big question was what to do about Pakistan, at a time when everyone was getting a darker and darker view of Pakistan, as Cohen put it. At the embassy in Kabul, they realized there had been a major turnover in personnel even in the months since their spring visit. The delegation from Washington knew more than the people briefing them. After one desultory session, Cohen and Lute headed to the men's room. Standing at the urinal, they remarked simultaneously, "We're fucked." Lute facilitated the final discussions in Room 445 and also weighed in with his own analysis of the Afghan War's fractured command structure. He created a PowerPoint deck with a slide titled, 10 Wars, referring to what his final count had determined were 10 distinctly commanded military forces in Afghanistan. How could they bring greater coherence to that effort? What if they adopted a more complete counterinsurgency approach inspired by their experience in Iraq? The core intelligence resource for the policy review was a national intelligence estimate on Afghanistan and Pakistan that Peter Lavoie had overseen across the summer and autumn. It acknowledged that the security situation in Afghanistan looked bleak, as a classified summary for NATO governments put it. The Afghan government has failed to consistently deliver services in rural areas. This has created a void that the Taliban and other insurgent groups have begun to fill in the southern, eastern, and some western provinces. The Taliban is mediating local disputes in some areas, for example, offering the population at least an elementary level of access to justice. The Taliban have effectively manipulated the grievances of disgruntled, disenfranchised tribes. The NIE endorsed Kilcullen's assessment of rising professionalism in Taliban guerrilla operations, presumably aided by the Pakistan Army. The guerrillas were demonstrating more sophisticated infantry, communications and command and control techniques. Their marksmanship is more precise, and their explosives more lethal than in previous years. The NIE predicted that even if the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police could be funded and trained into a professional force of several hundred thousand men, that project would be insufficient if Pakistan remains a safe haven for insurgents. Equally, solving the problem of the Pakistani sanctuary abetted by ISI was necessary but insufficient to win in Afghanistan. That would require addressing the severe governance, development, and access to justice gaps. The estimate rendered a split verdict on ISI's culpability and Kayani's role. Pakistan now identifies both al-Qaeda and the Taliban as existential threats, the estimate concluded. But the Taliban that bothered Kayani was the Pakistani branch, not the Afghan one. To influence Afghanistan, ISI's Directorate S still provides intelligence and financial support to insurgent groups attacking NATO and Indian targets inside Afghanistan. Briefing the findings to NATO, Peter Lavoie said that ISI's aid to the Taliban was explained by three factors. First, Pakistan believes the Taliban will prevail in the long term, at least in the Pashtun belt most proximate to the Pakistani border. Second, Pakistan continues to define India as the number one threat and insists that India seeks to undermine Pakistani security through covert operations inside Afghanistan. Third, Pakistan's high command believes that if militant groups were not attacking in Afghanistan, they would seek out Pakistani targets. The world outside Room 445 changed dramatically during the 2 months that the review went on. The study began as Lehman Brothers failed, touching off the worst financial crisis and recession since the Great Depression. The collapsing economy lifted Obama's presidential prospects, and by October, it seemed likely that the deputies would hand off their findings to a Democratic administration. Before the election, members of Lute's staff met advisors to both the Obama and McCain campaigns informally at the Army-Navy Club. They discussed with them the Afghan War's deterioration and the policy questions it raised. Obama had made clear during his campaign that he favored more effort in Afghanistan, but his specific views about troop levels and military doctrine were unclear. Lute completed the final top-secret report, about 40 pages in length, about 10 days after Obama was elected president. "The United States is not losing in Afghanistan, but it is not winning either, and that is not good enough," read the first sentence. The report made 10 recommendations about fighting the Taliban, including the dispatch of more troops a more ambitious effort to train and equip Afghan forces, tackling corruption, and finding an approach to counter drug operations that would starve the Taliban of finance without alienating farmers, a form of drug policy for which NATO had been searching without success for at least 4 years. At the Pentagon, Gates authorized preparations to send 2 more American brigades to Afghanistan, if the next president chose to do so. The review also urged that Afghanistan and Pakistan be organized as a single theater. A theme of the review, at least for some of the analysts involved, was the need to re-Americanize the effort, as Elliot Cohen put it. It had become a NATO war, but it was not going to succeed that way. Bush had also prepared to hand off to Obama the expanding CIA drone campaign in the tribal areas that he had approved in July. In the 4 months between that decision and the completion of Lute's strategy review, the CIA had carried out 23 drone strikes on Pakistani soil, more than in the previous 4 years combined. Mike D'Andrea now oversaw what amounted to an undeclared air war in the federally administered tribal areas waged from the Global Response Center on the Langley campus. CIA mission leaders tracked drone feeds on the Response Center's big screens, while Air Force pilots and sensor operators flew the missions more than 2,000 miles away at Creech Air Force Base in Indian Springs, Nevada. The first strike under the new rules killed 7 foreigners in Azam Warsak village in South Waziristan, according to a ledger of attacks kept by the FATA government. In North Waziristan, the CIA fired missiles at a dozen Haqqani-linked targets, some of them long ago mapped and surveyed in Narancha and contiguous Dandeh Darpakel, where the Haqqanis ran their large madrasa. The first 2 dozen strikes killed 40 foreigners, but also 178 locals, according to the Pakistani government count. On September 8, 2008, missiles demolished a North Waziristan home belonging to Jalaluddin Haqqani. He was absent, but al-Qaeda's latest chief in Pakistan, Abu Haris, was reportedly killed. 8 women and 5 children also died, according to the FATA records. They record 10 other cases of civilian casualties between September and December of 2008. In all of 2008, at least 1 child was killed in a third of all CIA drone strikes, according to the available figures. A shocking percentage, if accurate. It would require CIA mission managers several more years of intensive drone operations in the tribal areas before they reduced such mistakes to rarities. Because drones could dwell above a target for hours or days, multiple analysts usually had ample time to confirm that a target was valid. Yet the available record suggests that D'Andrea oversaw a relatively indiscriminate first season of strikes at FATA before experience and improved technology reduced child and civilian deaths. The essential problem was that without reliable human agents reporting in real time on the ground from a village or town under surveillance, video imagery and fragmentary phone intercepts could not, in every instance, clarify the identities of the individuals being surveyed for death. And because the CIA's targeting rules had deliberately been loosened to allow drone strikes that more resembled conventional Air Force bombing, the risk of error expanded. Just as had been the case during the botched Mullah Muhammad Omar drone operation in the fall of 2001, secrecy rules meant pilots and sensor operators at Creech had no access to the details of CIA intelligence. That left the pilots as trigger pullers following orders. The pilots could certainly object and hold off if they saw women and children in the target area, but where the imagery might be ambiguous, they had to rely on superiors' understanding of secret intelligence they could not access. The larger question involved the strategic impact of ramped-up Predator attacks. Steve Kappas and other CIA operations veterans referred to armed drones as a homeland security weapon. They meant it could be effective as a tactic against terrorists identified as active plotters against American targets at home or abroad. They pointed out, however, that predator strikes did not constitute a strategy to stop the sweep of terrorism or the attraction of dangerous numbers of young men to a jihadist cause larger than themselves. In Pakistan, it soon became evident that the tactical punch of the CIA's secret air war had to be weighed against the boomerang effect on Pakistani political and public opinion. As evidence of civilian casualties mounted, Pakistani media publicized the strikes critically, perhaps encouraged by ISI's media wing. Of course, any country with free media would protest attacks on its territory that killed innocents, and when the attacking country was the United States, a hyperpower, seemingly unaccountable, the outrage and resistance within Pakistan was hardly surprising. The American attitude was, "We are not asking for permission." Patterson and the CIA station briefed diverse Pakistani officials about the new American strike policy. The briefings were declarations, not requests for acquiescence, sweetened with pledges of cooperation and expressions of appreciation for Pakistan's partnership. On November 19th, CIA drone operators strayed outside the federally administered tribal areas and the authorized flight corridors previously agreed with Kayani to unleash missiles on a compound in Banu, in the settled areas of Pakistan. The strike reportedly killed a Saudi leader of Al-Qaeda, another Arab, two Turkmen, and a local militant. Like the September special operations raid on Angur Adda, the attack in mainland Pakistan visibly challenged the government's sovereignty and stretched the tolerance even of sympathetic civilian Pakistani politicians, never mind nationalists like Pasha. "Give U.S. an inch, and it'll take a mile," blared a typical headline after the dead and wounded were hauled from the rubble. Zardari, normally compliant, told visiting American generals that month that he did not mind paying the price for high-value targets, but it did not appear that Osama bin Laden had been in your sights lately. The United States had never scored well in public opinion surveys in Pakistan, but its favorability ratings were sinking toward new lows in the single digits, below India's. Lute presented the Afghan Review's findings to Bush and the National Security Council in late November, before Thanksgiving. "Putting counterinsurgency in front of counterterrorism as a priority is a significant shift," Gates observed. "That's an entirely different ballgame in terms of resources." He worried that if too many U.S. troops poured into Afghanistan now, they would be seen as the Soviets were, provoking deeper resistance. "The Afghan army must gain the ability and numbers to do the job," he said. "Is that realistic?" Bush asked. "The Afghan army is getting there," Lute advised, "but the police are a long way off." Bush returned to the central logic problem. The review proposed new investments of American blood and treasure to stabilize Afghanistan, yet Al-Qaeda was in Pakistan, as was the Taliban's leadership. "Targeting is ongoing in Waziristan," Lute said, referring to the CIA's stepped-up drone program. "But Quetta, where the Taliban leadership resided, is going untouched." "Is Quetta a realistic goal?" Bush asked. "We need to get Pakistani concurrence," CIA Director Michael Hayden argued. "Quetta is considered part of Pakistan proper. What goes on in Waziristan and the other tribal areas is much more of a gray area. I make no apologies for them, but for the Pak Army, the Quetta Shura is a strategic hedge against our withdrawal from Afghanistan, and they aren't likely to go after them any time soon." "Can't we get after them unilaterally?" Bush pressed. "Sir, buildings blowing up in the midst of one of Pakistan's major cities is a lot different than an isolated mud hut getting struck out in the mountains somewhere," Hayden answered. "For American forces to go into Quetta on the ground, even with Pakistani cooperation, if it could somehow be obtained, will be like taking on the mafia on their home turf. Everyone will know you're coming, and it won't be pretty," Hayden continued. "They would have to accept that, outside the FATA, They were dependent on Pakistan. Bush approved the report, but told his cabinet that he wanted to identify only those recommendations that required immediate action. Steve Hadley checked with the incoming Obama team, and they signaled that they preferred that we pass along our report quietly. Lute did brief Obama's transition team, but they were noncommittal about the recommendations for more troops and money. Of course, Lute did not expect Obama's advisors to exclaim, "Thank God, Bush just gave us the answers." "Peace be upon you." "How are you?" Sajid Mir, a commander in Lashkar-e-Taiba, the ISI-nurtured force that sought the liberation of Kashmir from India, spoke by telephone from Karachi to a terrorist in the midst of a two-day assault on Mumbai, India's financial capital. Sajid had grown up in Karachi. His father worked in Saudi Arabia, where he visited frequently. He was a worldly man who had traveled to Dubai, Qatar, Syria, Thailand, and Canada. He carried multiple passports and used several aliases. "Doing well," the commander's fighter in Mumbai said. "What are the conditions, brother?" "It's normal at our end for the time being." "Is there any firing?" "No, not towards us." "Should they keep the hostages or kill them?" Sajid appeared to be posing the question to a colleague with him in the Karachi command center. "Kill them," the colleague instructed. "Okay, listen," Sajid continued. "Yes, yes." "Get rid of them right now. Rid yourself of them, friend. Do it. Do it." "I said, I'm listening. Do it." "Should we open fire?" "Yeah, do it. Make him sit. Have him face the front and place it on the back side of his head, then shoot." 10 heavily armed Pakistani citizens landed after dark on Mumbai's Nariman Point on November 23, 2008. Only hours after Bush approved the new Afghan war strategy review. The terrorists had been trained for 3 months at two Lashkar camps, one in Karachi and the other near Thatta in Sindh province. Trainers told the volunteers initially that they would fight their way to escape following their raid on Mumbai. Later, in September 2008, the plan changed. Now they would fight to the death. A Lashkar commander thought this plan was better because it would cause the boys to fight harder. Hafiz Saeed, the spiritual and political leader of Lashkar, which he had founded in the 1980s, as the armed wing of a proselytizing movement, delivered motivational lectures to the 10 boys alongside Zaki-ur-Rahman Lakhvi, Lashkar's military commander. Lakhvi's black beard fell to his chest. He had at least 8 children by 3 wives, and one of his sons had died fighting in Kashmir. Saeed assured the boys that being shot would feel like a pinprick, bloodstains would be like rose petals, and that angels would come down to take their souls. After 2 failed attempts, the squad departed Karachi by boat on November 22nd, hijacked an Indian fishing vessel, murdered 4 of the crew, and ordered the captain to navigate to Mumbai. 4 miles offshore, they murdered the captain and loaded weapons into their dinghy. On shore, they split into 5 teams of 2. Their initial targets included a synagogue, a cafe, a large railway station, and 2 seaside luxury hotels, the Oberoi Trident Hotel and the Taj Mahal Hotel. They terrorized hostages before murdering them. The siege lasted more than 48 hours, the most dramatic and sophisticated televised terrorist attack worldwide since September 11th. The raiding team killed at least 166 people, the great majority civilians, including 6 Americans, one of them a 13-year-old girl. 9 of the 10 terrorists died. Indian police arrested the survivor, Ajmal Kasab, whom they soon identified as a Pakistani from the Punjab. American and allied spy services had run intercept coverage of the communications between the attackers and their handlers in Karachi. An international team of intelligence leaders specializing in South Asia including the acting CIA station chief in Islamabad, arranged a meeting at ISI, and drove to the Pakistani services headquarters carrying maps and link charts depicting the call.